most of the guidelines across the world are in agreement about which antihypertensive medication to start first. And it's all thanks to the ALLHAT trial. The ALLHAT trial is by far the most important clinical trial ever done in the management of hypertension. It answers the question, which class of antihypertensive medication is the best for reducing cardiovascular disease? And it is the definitive source for the answer. Let's take a look. Hello and welcome to the Evidence-Based Medicine Podcast, where we go through the evidence that will help improve our practice. I'm Daniel Aronoff, and today, the ALLHAT trial. Which antihypertensive is best? This trial randomized a whopping 42,000 patients to get one of the four antihypertensive medications, an ACE inhibitor, a calcium channel blocker, a thiazide, or an alpha blocker. The ACE inhibitor they used was lisinopril, the calcium channel blocker was amlodipine, the thiazide was chlorthalidone, and the alpha blocker was doxazosin, brand name Cardura. They followed them up for a really long time as well, between 4 to 8 years, and they wanted to see how many in each group developed cardiovascular disease. Perhaps one class of antihypertensive is better than the others. Now, this trial was started in the mid-90s when the thiazide chlorthalidone had been around for ages and the case for lowering blood pressure was now well established. Now, this may come as a surprise, but the issue of whether lowering blood pressure did any good was pretty controversial for quite some time. But now that it had been established, lots of new agents were coming on board, each being like 10 times the price of chlorthalidone. So this study really tried to find whether the new expensive ACE inhibitors or calcium channel blockers or alpha blockers were actually any better than good old cheap chlorthalidone. A lot of people haven't heard of chlorthalidone, which is sad because it was one of the first thiazide diuretics and there are signals in the evidence that it may be better than the other thiazides like hydrochlorothiazide, which is very commonly used. In fact, the UK NICE guidelines recommend choosing chlorthalidone over hydrochlorothiazide. We'll have to go through the chlorthalidone versus hydrochlorothiazide evidence at some other stage, but I guess the biggest factor that has depopularized chlorthalidone is that it's so far off patent that there's no money to be made on it anymore, and so there's no real marketing for this drug. Anyway, that's the thiazide that they used in this trial. So who were these 42,000 people? Well, they were recruited from 623 centers in the United States, Canada, and Puerto Rico between 1994 and 1998. There were three main inclusion criteria. The first was that they had to be 55 years or older. Secondly, they had to have hypertension as defined as either a systolic blood pressure greater than 140 or a diastolic blood pressure greater than 90. And thirdly, they had to have one additional risk factor for cardiovascular disease on top of hypertension. And this could be either a previous heart attack, type 2 diabetes, currently smoking, left ventricular hypertrophy on ECG or echo, or an elevated cholesterol. They only excluded those who had symptomatic heart failure. Now, these patients were not excluded if they were already on antihypertensives. In fact, 90% of them were, but they stopped all of them when the study started. So on the day of randomization, they had to stop all of the antihypertensives that they were taking. The next day, they started their study drug. That way they were testing that particular drug in the purest possible way. They concealed allocation and then randomized to a 1.7:1:1:1 ratio so that more participants were in the thiazide group. They followed them up every 3 months in the first year and then every 4 months in the following years. They would check their blood pressure and increase the dose of their study drug to get it down below 140/90. If they couldn't do that with the maximal dose of the drug that they were assigned to, then they could add either atenolol, clonidine, or reserpine. And this was up to the doctor that was treating them. So unlike how we would treat hypertension now, these patients could only have either calcium channel blocker or ACE inhibitor or thiazide. If they needed more, they had to pick from other drugs. Nowadays, we'd give all three of these drugs before moving to either atenolol, clonidine, or reserpine, but they needed to keep the groups as purest as possible. So what were the outcomes? Well, the primary outcome they were looking for was heart attack, either fatal heart attacks or non-fatal heart attacks. Secondary outcomes included stroke, all-cause mortality, cancer, GI bleeding, and end-stage renal failure and a composite of all the bad cardiovascular outcomes. So, who did they manage to recruit? Well, the average age was 67, half of them were women, the average blood pressure was 146 on 84, 22% were smoking. How times have changed. Now in the US and Canada, smoking rates are down to about 15%. 51% had established cardiovascular disease, 36% had type 2 diabetes, and what else? The average BMI was 29.2, and around 30% were black. Around 15,000 were randomized to chlorthalidone, and around 9,000 to each of doxazosin, lisinopril, and amlodipine. They stopped the trial in 2002, so those who were recruited in 1994 were followed up for 8 years, while those who were recruited in 1998 were followed up for 4 years. On average, the follow-up was 5 years. So what did they find? Well, isn't this exciting? Firstly, the alpha blocker doxazosin, brand name Carjura, got the boot pretty quickly. They stopped the doxazosin arm of the trial early because an interim analysis showed that it was inferior. They published this interim analysis on doxazosin in a separate article before the results of the main trial came out. It was in JAMA in the year 2000. So after an average of 3.3 years of follow-up for this interim analysis, they found that, compared to the thiazide chlorthalidone, those getting the alpha blocker doxazosin had a 25% increase in adverse cardiovascular outcomes. It went from 21.67% in the chlorthalidone group to 25.45% in the doxazosin group, making a number needed to harm of 27, which means that for every 27 patients you decide to treat with doxazosin over chlorthalidone, one will develop an extra adverse cardiovascular outcome. Congenital heart failure doubled. It went from 4.45% in the chlorthalidone group to 8.13% in the doxazosin group, making a number needed to harm of 27. And if you look at the graph of heart failure rates over time, they seem to be getting further and further apart, which suggests that the increase in heart failure rates would have been even worse as time went on. Now, this was the first ever decent study to compare an alpha blocker to another class of antihypertensives, and it pretty much spelled the end of doxazosin for the treatment of hypertension. At least, it should have. In fact, it didn't. See, Pfizer, who brought doxazosin to market under the brand name Carjura, was also one of the sponsors of the All-Hat trial, so they became aware of the results before the trial was published. Now, what do you do when one of your drugs is found to be harming people? Do you pull it from the market? Do you put a little warning on the box? No. You pump out hundreds of millions of dollars in a marketing and damage control campaign. In fact, the sales of doxazosin, or Carjura, were completely unscathed after this trial was published, with virtually no change in the $800 million of sales per year for this drug. I'm not making this up. You can find an article on this published in the BMJ. I'll actually include it in the show notes. Some internal documents leaked from Pfizer to show the techniques that they used. They got an external research agency to study the doctor's awareness of this preliminary report from the All Hat trial. When the agency found that, and I quote from their document, "knowledge of the trial's preliminary results is minimal for all specialties," they took great steps to make sure, as best as possible, that word did not get out. But you probably don't want to hear about the steps they took, do you? Nah, let's move on. Alright, fine. So the documents found that, firstly, Pfizer deliberately did not issue a statement about the All Hat results, which, you know, you should probably do if it turns out your drug is doubling people's chance of getting heart failure. But no, why would you when it, and I quote, "would likely draw more media attention to the situation." Secondly, they taught their drug reps to provide information about the All Hat trial only when asked. And how's this for a bit of genius? At the American College of Cardiology conference in California in the year 2000, Dr. Furberg, who was the lead researcher of the All Hat trial, was set to give a presentation on the All Hat results. So what did Pfizer do? They brought in the top big shot cardiologists to do a tour at the same time as the presentation, therefore keeping the doctors who attended the conference from attending the talk on the All Hat trial. Amazing, huh? In fact, a document leaked where the two Pfizer employees who came up with this idea were praised as being quite brilliant by their management. So what are the common arguments by doctors who insist on seeing drug reps? Well, they don't impact on my prescribing choices. I don't fall for their marketing strategies. Or I like them because it keeps me up to date. But can you see now that they're actually ruining medicine? If drug reps don't work on you, then how do you explain that one of the biggest landmark trials in cardiovascular disease was unable to influence prescribing? I mean, it has now, but it took a long time. Now, the blood pressure reductions between chlorthalidone and doxazosin were pretty much the same, around 2 millimeters of mercury between them. So I think this is an important lesson that blood pressure reduction is not equal. A 10 millimeter mercury reduction in blood pressure with one class of drug will impact on cardiovascular disease differently than a 10 millimeter of mercury reduction with another drug. And this is the same for everything, cholesterol, HbA1c, and it's why we need to ask for clinical trials to show us the impact on hard outcomes rather than these surrogate markers, like this ALLHAT trial brilliantly did. Okay, let's go to the rest of the results. So the results for the other three antihypertensives, ACE inhibitors, calcium channel blockers, and thiazides, was published in 2002 in JAMA. This is so exciting. So the primary outcome, which was fatal or non-fatal heart attacks, was the same in all three groups. It occurred in 11.5% of the participants, regardless of which antihypertensive they got. But it's the secondary outcomes where some differences lie, and seem to be in favor of chlorthalidone. Let's start with chlorthalidone versus the calcium channel blocker amlodipine. So there was actually a 40% relative increase in heart failure with amlodipine compared to chlorthalidone. It went from 7.7% to 10.2%, making a number needed to harm of 40. There was an increase in coronary revascularization with amlodipine as well. It went from 9.2% to 10%. The p-value was 0.06 though. But peripheral vascular disease decreased with amlodipine by 0.4%. It went from 4.1% to 3.7%. Again, the p-value was 0.06, so just short of that arbitrary cutoff for statistical significance. All the other outcomes, stroke, end-stage renal disease, cancer, and all-cause mortality were the same between the two. And it didn't matter if they were male or female, older or younger, black or white, or diabetic or non-diabetic, the results were consistent across all these groups. All right, so what about chlorthalidone versus the ACE inhibitor, lisinopril? So here again, chlorthalidone came out on top. There was a 15% relative increase in stroke with the ACE inhibitor compared to the thiazide. It went from 5.6% to 6.3%, making a number needed to harm of 143. And the combined cardiovascular outcome was also worse for the ACE inhibitor. It went from 30.9% to 33.3%, so a number needed to harm of 41, which means that for every 41 people you choose to give an ACE inhibitor instead of chlorthalidone to treat hypertension, you cause one extra adverse cardiovascular outcome. Heart failure was also worse with lisinopril, with a number needed to harm of 100, which I find fascinating because ACE inhibitors have been proven to save lives and be effective in heart failure. More people developed angina with lisinopril, number needed to harm of 67, and there was more coronary revascularization. But surely end-stage renal failure was better with ACE inhibitors, right? After all, it is the renoprotective antihypertensive, isn't it? Well, no. There was no difference in end-stage renal failure. It was 2% for those taking lisinopril versus 1.8% in those taking chlorthalidone. So if anything, trending in the wrong direction for ACE inhibitors, but obviously this was not statistically significant. There was also no difference in all-cause mortality, peripheral arterial disease, or cancer. But, and here's where it gets interesting, they did a lot of subgroup analyses. And we've spoken about subgroup analyses in the past and their limitations, but they did show that with certain age ranges and with certain races, lisinopril was not worse than chlorthalidone. So when they looked at those under the age of 65, there was no difference in the combined cardiovascular disease outcome between lisinopril and chlorthalidone. It was only in those over the age of 65 where lisinopril was worse. They also did a subgroup analysis based on race, because there had been reports that ACE inhibitors do not achieve as good a blood pressure reduction in black populations. And they did find that lisinopril was worse in black people. So there was a 40% increase in stroke in black people taking lisinopril, but no increase in stroke rates in white people taking lisinopril. Similarly, with that combined cardiovascular outcome, it increased by 20% in black people taking lisinopril, but only increased by 6% in white people taking lisinopril. So when we go through all the guidelines, you'll see that some of them have different recommendations based on age and race, and this all stems from the ALLHAT trial. But apart from those two differences in age and race, clothalidone was still consistently better in all the other subgroups they looked at, diabetics and non-diabetics and men and women. So what happened to their blood pressure in each of the groups? Well, they were actually statistically different. Whether they were clinically or meaningfully different is another story. So at 5 years, the systolic blood pressure was 134 for clothalidone, 134.7 for amlodipine, and 135.9 for lisinopril. So a 2 millimeters of mercury difference between clothalidone and lisinopril. Could that be the sole reason for the worse outcomes with lisinopril? I highly doubt it, but it could be. And even if it is, it still puts thiazides ahead in my books because, great, it's better at reducing blood pressure than the others. Now let's talk about side effects. So at the end of the 5 years, 20% of those in each of the clothalidone and the amlodipine group were no longer actually taking the drugs, while 28% were no longer taking lisinopril by this same time. The most common reason was because of adverse effects or the patient just refused to take it after a certain point. So it seems more people were stopping the lisinopril than the other two drugs. They did collect some limited data on other adverse events. Angioedema occurred 4 times more in the lisinopril group than the other groups, but it was still pretty rare, occurring in about 1 in every 250 people taking lisinopril. They measured potassium levels and found that hypokalemia occurred more commonly with clothalidone. So at the start of the study, before any of them were given any of their study drug, around 3% had a potassium less than 3.5. In those randomized to clothalidone, 8.5% developed a potassium less than 3.5, while only 1% did with lisinopril and 1.9% with amlodipine. All right, that's pretty much all I wanted to share. Now, there was a separate study within this study, which I didn't mention. So for everyone who had elevated cholesterol in this study, for which there was 20,000 of them, they randomized those to either get a statin or a placebo. I guess they thought, well, we're spending billions of dollars recruiting and following these people up. We might as well check if statins work as well. Now, I didn't want to go into this study because I just didn't think it was as groundbreaking as the antihypertensive component. I think the efficacy of statins is pretty well established, but maybe we can talk about this arm in another episode. Too much information for today. So that's it. Well, what's the bottom line? Here goes. The ALLHAT study is the most definitive study to compare different classes of antihypertensives in terms of their ability to reduce cardiovascular disease. They found that the alpha blocker, doxazosin, was significantly inferior, causing double the rate of congestive cardiac failure and a 25% relative increase in cardiovascular disease compared to clothalidone. The calcium channel blocker amlodipine was equivalent to clothalidone in terms of heart attacks, strokes, and cardiovascular disease, but in terms of heart failure, clothalidone was superior. Treatment with amlodipine resulted in a 40% increase in congestive cardiac failure with a number needed to harm of 40. Clothalidone seemed to be superior to ACE inhibitors as well. Treatment with lisinopril resulted in a 15% relative increase in stroke compared to treatment with clothalidone. It also resulted in an increase in cardiovascular disease with a number needed to harm of 41 and heart failure with a number needed to harm of 100. This increase in adverse cardiovascular outcomes with ACE inhibitors was much less profound in a subgroup analysis of only white people. So how did the guidelines respond to this piece of evidence? Let's start with the American guidelines, which are the Joint National Committee, or the JNC8 guidelines. In the general non-black population, including those with diabetes, initial antihypertensive treatment should include a thiazide diuretic, calcium channel blocker, ACE inhibitor, or angiotensin receptor blocker. In the general black population, including those with diabetes, initial treatment should include a thiazide diuretic or calcium channel blocker. So they're basically saying, use any unless it's for the black population, in which case don't use ACE inhibitors. Now, the Australian Heart Foundation hypertension guidelines say, in patients with uncomplicated hypertension, ACE inhibitors or ARBs, calcium channel blockers, and thiazide diuretics are all suitable first-line antihypertensive drugs, either as monotherapy or in some combinations unless contraindicated. So, the UK NICE guidelines also differentiate based on age. For under 55, they recommend starting with an ACE or an ARB. For over 55, all black people, they recommend starting with a calcium channel blocker. If a calcium channel blocker is not tolerated, then a thiazide diuretic. And they actually recommend using chlorthalidone or indapamide as the thiazide of choice rather than hydrochlorothiazide, as I mentioned before. One of my favorite NICE hypertension recommendations is prescribe non-proprietary drugs where these are appropriate and minimize cost. Actually, while we're on the topic of cost, can I just read you a few sentences from the author's conclusion? Because I think it's brilliant. Consideration of drug costs could have a major impact on the nation's healthcare expenditures. Based on previous data that show that diuretic use declined from 56% to 27% of antihypertensive prescriptions between 1982 and 1992, the healthcare system would have saved $3.1 billion in estimated cost of antihypertensive drugs had the pattern of prescription for treatment of hypertension remained at the 1982 level. So yeah, I personally always start with chlorthalidone. I usually use a really low dose, like 6.25 to 12.5 milligrams, and I find I don't get many electrolyte issues on those doses. But what do you do? Well, that's it from me. Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you find this podcast valuable, then please leave a comment on iTunes and tell some people about it. I'd really appreciate that. Check out my evidence-based videos on YouTube. Just search Dr. Dan in YouTube. And all the references and all the show notes will be found at the website, www.ebmpodcast.com. Okay, I'm Daniel Aronov, and I'll talk to you next time.